Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Jennifer Vey, director of the Ann T. and Robert M. Bass Center of Transformative Placemaking at the Brookings Institution, and I'm a senior fellow with the Metropolitan Policy Program. On behalf of the center and on behalf of the program, I really want to welcome and thank all of you for tuning into our discussion today on who gets access to public space during a pandemic. So since the early days of COVID-19's arrival in the U.S., researchers, journalists, and other prognosticators have been circling around the question of the role of density has played in helping to spread the virus and in helping to mitigate its impacts. Urban Twitter has been a fire on the topic, and a flurry of articles, blogs, and podcasts have explored the issue from many angles and with varying points of view. Density isn't a singular condition, though, and how people experience it, good, bad, or otherwise, depends on the home in which they live, the neighborhoods that surround them, and the way in which they travel from one place to another. It is also often determined by the color of their skin and how much money that they have in their bank account. These disparities long predated the assault of COVID-19, but the virus has preyed upon them in some pretty horrible ways. New research by the Economic Innovation Group shows that over the past several decades, the number of high poverty communities and the number of people living in them has risen dramatically, and there are wide racial and ethnic gaps. Hispanic residents are four times as likely as non-Hispanic whites to live in a high poverty neighborhood, and Black residents are nearly six times as likely. These are many of the same neighborhoods where low-wage workers, many of whom are now finally understood to be essential, experience many of the negative and today downright dangerous parts of dense urban living. They're the neighborhoods where housing conditions are crowded or substandard, but where basic goods and services are often sparse, where vacant housing may be ubiquitous, even while many of the residents are housing insecure. And unsurprisingly, there are many of the very same neighborhoods where the number of those who have become sick or who have died from the virus are the most concentrated. So we're not going to tackle all these issues in our webcast today, but we are going to explore one key factor in how the conditions of urban density are felt. That is the extent to which people living in underserved communities have access to safe, high-quality public spaces. So our discussion today is going to focus on the efforts of three organizations to provide equitable access to public spaces, both prior to COVID-19 and right now during the pandemic's reign. We will also explore how we can, how we must, be thinking far more expansively and creatively about how our public realm can be reimagined to confer health, social, environmental, and even economic benefits to far more people and far more communities. So I'm thrilled today to be able to have this conversation with three experts on these issues. Warren Logan, who's the Policy Director of Mobility and Interagency Relations in the Oakland Mayor's Office. Carol Coletta, President and CEO of the Memphis River Parks Partnership. And Phil Myrick, CEO of Project for Public Spaces. So during the program, just one housekeeping measure, you can submit questions for panelists by emailing events@brookings.edu. or tweeting to @BrookingsMetro using the hashtag public space. So I'll try to ask some of these questions in our last 15 minutes or so of our webcast. So now I want to dive into it. So to start off, what I'd like each of you to do is to give a little bit of background on your work and your organization and how you've approached the issues of equity in the public realm prior to COVID-19. So let's start with Warren. Warren, can you talk about some of the ways that Oakland has identified its underserved communities and has worked to expand and enhance mobility options for these neighborhoods? What are some of the major equity challenges that your office has been trying to address?
Sure. Thanks, Jennifer. I'll actually start with basically your introduction, which is that the way that we identified the underserved neighborhoods, unfortunately, hasn't changed. The underserved neighborhoods have been the same for a very long time, and they remain underserved today. And that's really the foundation of where we started. So if you look at, for example, where our redlining maps were in Oakland, and then overlap that with collision history in Oakland, or if you look at statistics for where people lack access to jobs or lack access to basic mobility solutions, all of those are the same areas. And so we're really just digging into the exact same locations and saying, how do we provide a holistic view for, addressing these historic racist injustices, quite frankly, and sort of looking back at the history of some of our more recent transportation initiatives, the city of Oakland actually prioritized our something as basic as road repaving, primarily in districts in East Oakland that have not received repaving in over 100 years in some cases. And it may look kind of basic to just repave streets in neighborhoods that have, you know, lacked that, but people take pride in public space when they are invested in. And so that's just an example of the way that we look at that. Moving forward, we also recognize though, and again, I'll remind everyone that I'm the mayor's policy director for mobility and interagency relations, is that we can't just approach issues in a silo. So even though I work hand in glove with our Department of Transportation to address transportation challenges in Oakland and quite frankly in the Bay Area, I also recognize that we can't approach our community members, especially our disadvantaged Black and Brown community members, with just transportation solutions, because I may say, hey, do you want a bike lane? And they're saying to us, I want a job, I want investment, I want healthcare. And so we have to always be looking at this as a holistic conversation. I'll touch on that a little bit more in our conversation, I think, but I'll leave it there for now. But that's the way that we approach, sorry, my puppy is licking my hand at the same time. That's the way that we approach injustices in Oakland. Sorry.
Thanks, Lauren. So Carol, can you tell us a little bit about the Memphis Riverfront Parks partnership and the ways in which a focus on equity is really integrated into so much of your work, from workforce issues, hiring practices, to the way in which you program your public spaces?
It is. Thanks, Jennifer. Memphis River Parks Partnership is a 501c3. It's a public-private partnership. It's been in business for 20 years when long ago the city decided it could not care for its riverfront in the way that it thought it should, and invited this organization to form and to do this work. So we manage 5 miles of riverfront, which for many, many years has not been thought of as connected even park to park, north, south along the Mississippi River, but certainly not connected from west, which is where our river is, back to the east and to neighborhoods. So this riverfront is adjacent to downtown, which is thriving, but also 3 very impoverished neighborhoods that have all the health and economic challenges that poverty brings. So, you know, when we think about the riverfront, we start, our mission starts with working with and for the people of Memphis. I don't care if you own a house, if you rent a house, if you have no house at all, if you live in the city of Memphis, you own a piece of this riverfront. So because we run public parks, we start, I think, with equity as an underpinning, you know, foundation for what we do. And then we pursue an equity strategy, I guess, at a high level or a general level, as pay and opportunity for our employees, free quality programming for people with intentional mixing of people across incomes and across ages, very aggressive MWBE contracting, as well as purchasing, involving Memphians, especially children, in shaping the parks and their future, and also connecting, as I said earlier, connecting the riverfront back into neighborhoods that are most challenged.
Great, thank you. Phil, so Project for Public Spaces was established about 45 years ago to help people create and sustain public spaces that really just help to build communities. So how do you engage with communities to ensure that your projects aren't just accessible to diverse groups of people, but actually are designed by these groups so that the spaces are reflective of the vision, the values, and the needs of the population that they're really meant to serve?
Sure. Thanks, Jennifer. So our mission is really built around the idea that great public spaces strengthen communities and the people in them. But also the public spaces are only able to fulfill that potential when the people who use those public spaces every day can take part in the process of imagining, you know, what purpose they'll be put to and how they can be a central part of the community, the community's life. And so, you know, this idea of community participation is really at the heart of our work. And if done the right way, you know, our process is around building trust and building social ties, and that the public space becomes the setting for communities to build that trust among themselves. Projects that don't really meaningfully engage diverse audiences, they don't tend to have that same effect, and they tend to underperform. So I'll give you one example. A lot of our work is actually in neighborhoods, in cities that may be struggling along various metrics, you know, whether it's economically or losing population or fraying around the edges, losing their sense of identity. A few years ago in Detroit, working with the Kresge Foundation and one of the CDCs, the CDC had started a food growing program using local youth and was, you know, had asked us to take a look at, you know, is there an opportunity here to improve the overall look and character of this little corner grocer that we want to improve and sell fresh food, and this vacant lot that had this, you know, sort of decrepit old basketball hoop. And so, but you know, you never know what the opportunity is until you start really probing what the neighborhood ideas are. So, you know, our engagement process, you know, started in a somewhat traditional way, but it wasn't really reaching the right people. So some local folks suggested we do a festival. So we did a harvest party, and all kinds of people came out of the woodwork. I think about 400 or 500 people. And, you know, one of the placemaking outcomes was actually that they continued to do that festival year after year. But what we heard overwhelmingly was not concerns about the public space so much as, you know, how do we get a job? Similar to Warren's point that, you know, we can go in there with a preconceived notion, maybe like biking is really important, or, you know, this is one of the big priorities or opportunities here. And then you hear something completely different. And so in this case, it transformed the project where, you know, in addition to this corner grocer and improving this decrepit lot, the decision was to put in a community kitchen, and that every block association leader got a key to that kitchen, and they used it as a place to foster entrepreneurship and teach cooking classes. And, you know, people wound up starting small businesses out of that kitchen. So it really, you know, we have a certain expertise, but community people bring, you know, the magic. And if you don't listen to that and really combine those ideas and combine the resources and expertise that all the different actors bring, including the community, projects just don't go the way they could, and we can't address community's problems the way they want them addressed.
Sure. Well, you know, clearly, I think for all of you, the fact that you've been focusing on these equity issues, you know, prior to COVID has put you in a much better position to be trying to ensure that you have more equitable access to public space during this moment. So let's talk about some of those issues, and particularly some of the equity challenges that have been exacerbated by COVID-19. And really just, you know, how your organizations are responding. So, you know, certainly we know that sheltering in place orders around the country have heightened the need to provide spaces, whether that's parks and plazas, streets, sidewalks, where people can exercise, where they can recreate, where they can get a little bit of fresh air, where they can get away from maybe some of the family members or others they've been, you know, holed up with over the last couple of months. And we know that this is really particularly crucial in communities where private outdoor spaces, such as yards or even balconies, are really limited or they're non-existent. And, you know, where their indoor spaces may simply be pretty crowded and pretty cramped. So, Carol, let's start with you on this. What are some of the biggest challenges in Memphis in terms of safe access to public space during the pandemic? And how has the partnership been adapting its practices to expand and enhance that access to parks, really for those who need them the most?
Well, let me say, our parks did not close during, like parks in some places did. So our team has been coming to work every day. So when I think about safety, I worry first about my team because they've been out there every day doing their jobs that they normally do. So first and foremost, it's what about the safety of the staff? But what's been really interesting is to, and again, keep in mind, we would be considered, on our way to being a glamour asset because we're on a river, but we're also in very close proximity to people who are, their households are very low income. So, and what we've seen is during this time, they're coming and they continue to come. They come on foot. They come on bike share, which has been made free during this time. They come on scooters. They come in cars. And so that's been really interesting. And as we closed our facilities, our restrooms, our parking lot, they still found ways to come. And they're there every day, every night. In fact, one of the beautiful things has been watching people, sort of reassert what's great about public space. When gyms have been closed, of course, all those gym classes now take place in the park and other people are joining in. And I see it individually as well as groups, socially distanced, of course. And so that's been kind of wonderful to see. I'll just say one thing. Our mayor made a very sudden, I think unplanned, but very big move when he closed a major 4-lane road that separates our downtown from our riverfront, which creates access problems that we're trying to plan our way out of. But in the near term, he closed that street and it has made the riverfront parks more accessible than ever before because people now don't have to cross 4 lanes of traffic to get there and they don't feel threatened by that traffic. It's completely safe. And so people have taken up this wonderful just strolling a mile out and a mile back every evening during sunset. And it really is just absolutely glorious. So access in terms of the space we manage has not really been an issue. Safety is always an issue, both for our staff. And then our staff interacts with guests, with our owners and our stakeholders. And, we remind them of distancing when we have to, but we try to do it with a smile as hosts.
Can I just ask one follow-up conversation? So obviously you manage, a large acreage of parks along the river, and you noted that parks in Memphis haven't shut down. To what extent are there access issues around the city of Memphis? You mentioned people driving, for example, to the riverfront. Is that because they don't have nearby access in their own communities?
Well, in part, it's because, it's two reasons, right? We, like many other cities, have not done a great job in recent years of maintaining our parks and doing the deferred maintenance. And, we've seen this in cities across America. And that's one of the beautiful things about what's happened in the last decade, I think, is there has been more imagination, more investment in the capital improvements in parks, and that's thanks to the work of a lot of organizations. On the other hand, it's still tough to get anyone managing a park, right? Any eyes on the park in an official way, and certainly they're not always maintained in the way that you'd like to see them maintained. So I think one of the reasons that people gravitate toward our parks on the riverfront is because we do have a higher level of maintenance and certainly a higher level of management, eyes in the park, people in the park. It's really, I think, it's a point that Warren made earlier about thinking about this holistically. You can solve some problems by tackling parks, but it really, if you want to solve the problem of access to parks, then you've got to solve the planning issue. You've got to solve the budget issue. You've got to solve the transportation mobility issue. All of those things come together when we talk about access to parks. Again, I would just say, though, that while we work to get those holistic solutions, and we all should, no matter what piece of this pie we're managing, I think we also have to start with the fact that those of us who are managing what is public, whether it's public transportation or public libraries or public parks, we shouldn't beat ourselves up too much, right? Because we are at least providing that free or low cost access to public. And I think we provide a foundation for our communities that are essential. And to the extent that that is lifted up and invested in and more people want that, we build that political support that is so badly needed to maintain these assets, to develop and maintain and manage these assets at a very high quality so that people, no matter how many financial options they have, will choose public. And again, that helps the politics considerably.
Carol, if you don't mind, I'd love to just tack on to one of your points that here in Oakland, we have a huge park that has a lake kind of dead center in the middle of downtown. For all of the viewers out there, you're welcome to visit when all of this shelter in place is over. One of the challenges we've noticed, though, in sort of the linchpin of all of these different issues that you and I've been highlighting, is that there's this issue of trust. And I think that's that middle component that sort of everything else circles around, because we've heard from a lot of our sort of Black and brown communities that they don't trust that they're not going to be policed when they go visit a park. And that has been this really critical element that is not just about physical access or even, you know, how I get to the park, whether it's well-maintained, et cetera. There is this distrust, understandably, that they're going to be policed differently when they're in a public space. And that's, I think, a component that I really want to highlight during this conversation, is that especially during COVID, we're sending these mixed signals, right? We're telling people, stay inside because it's safe, right? Don't touch anyone else. Don't spread the virus. And also saying, but please, you know, spread joy in the community when you're able to at a public park, stretch, relax, yoga, whatever. But there's this middle component that I think people of color are really challenged by, understandably, again, that am I going to be arrested for going outside when you've just told me that I should be inside? That has been a really big challenge for us. And I just want to sort of highlight that during this conversation as well.
Well, and it's a very mixed message that we're all getting. You know, what do we do? Do we bring our workforces back into the office? Not. What, you know, what are we supposed to do? So that's a challenge, I think, but generally. But I think the problem you're highlighting is an everyday problem. And it's one of the reasons that we have sort of reorganized our staff and our job descriptions. And we think about who is the mayor, you know, of this park, or who is the host of this park. And we try to get all of our rangers to think of themselves as greeters and just sort of spread community. I mean, that's the idea. And it's amazing the reaction that you get, but I agree with you. And I think I think it's one of the sad things about not having people in our parks on a regular basis. There's no one to organize the games, you know, there's no one to, and that's why I think that we are in a privileged position to be able to host and to have presence in our parks. And Memphis is a majority African-American city in a majority African-American county in a metro area where the largest demographic is African-American. And so obviously our workforce reflects our population. And I think that lessens the concern and the trust, the lack of trust, but it doesn't eliminate it. It's always there. And I think it's incumbent upon us to work hard to gain that trust. And I think it starts with just taking care of the place and being a friendly face and being human.
Thank you. Actually, Warren, I'm going to come back to you for a second. So, you know, there's been a really loud call in cities, not just in this country, but really around the world, to prioritize the ability of pedestrians and bikers and others who are not in cars to prioritize them on public streets during the pandemic, particularly in really densely populated areas where sidewalks often don't allow the kind of physical distancing that we all need to be undertaking. So the city of Oakland has restricted access on over 70 miles of streets within the city, which is pretty amazing. And I think you've really been at the forefront of this. So can you talk a little bit about like why and how you went about making the decision to do this? And particularly, how did you ensure that that decision benefited all Oakland communities? And as part of that, you know, in thinking about this issue of trust that you raised earlier, like have the decisions that you've made been pretty widely embraced or have there been some tensions?
All great questions. And it's exciting to be a part of an organization that is willing to take risks, especially during these really challenging moments. So I just really first want to celebrate our safety team for really jumping into the deep end almost overnight into taking on this really fantastic effort. That said, let's start with the why. I think that, and I almost want to circle all the way back to my original point, which is that in some ways I shouldn't have to explain to anyone like why a Department of Transportation would want to encourage safe streets ever, and then more importantly, during a time when our hospital beds, for example, are at limited capacity. And so I just want to like really underscore that this came from a public safety standpoint, that here in Oakland, we recognize that like many other major cities, we have a really big collision problem, especially fatal collisions between cars and people walking or bicycling. And, you know, we never want to see anyone dying on our street. So like first and foremost, safety is always on top of mind. So that's when we think about the why, right? It is even more important than when we think about the fact that so many people are concerned about their public health and their safety in this moment of stress and challenges for COVID, that we needed to take this even bigger jump to make sure that people were absolutely safe in whatever way we could. To speak to your how question, I think, you know, it was really exciting and quite fortuitous really that just last year we had adopted a bicycle plan that included thousands of people across the city engaging on what they wanted to see in their, when I say bicycle infrastructure, it's actually kind of funny because the plan, if you read it, I encourage anyone to read this plan. It's called Let's Bike Oakland. And it starts with the first chapter, which is called What We Heard. And we heard a lot of different challenges that people shared with us. Not just, I want to bike more, I don't feel safe bicycling. That's sort of the bread and butter of bike ped planning. But also things like, I don't feel comfortable bicycling because I'm concerned that I might get arrested for potentially people thinking I stole this bike. That's a really nuanced approach to bicycle and pedestrian planning that requires some really deep listening. And again, I want to congratulate our safety team on like spending thousands of hours collectively asking these like very deep questions. Why? You know, it's not just a matter of, why don't you bike? It's like, why don't you feel comfortable doing something that I think you would enjoy, but you're telling me you don't actually think is safe for you. So again, sort of circling back, we had this plan. We identified these neighborhood bikeways across the city, the 74 miles to be exact, and then just declared them safe streets, slow streets. And so it's actually kind of a funny story that we just reminded people of the neighborhood streets that they had just told us they wanted, that we were going to do it. So it's, in some ways it's groundbreaking because we made the news a bunch of times, but also if you look at what we did, we just reminded people that they deserved safe streets all the time. In terms of reception though, I think it's been really all over the map. If you follow Twitter, people are really excited. And I don't want to use Twitter as a barometer for virtually anything other than Twitter itself. But I like Twitter anyway. But we have, the city is sort of makes an L. So you've got sort of everyone who's west of the lake and then sort of east of the lake, which is East Oakland, deep East Oakland, and then on into San Leandro, which is our neighboring city. But for half the city, they're saying, we need this permanently. This is fantastic. I'm rollerblading with my kids in the streets. This is awesome. That's North Oakland. That's West Oakland, right? Then you have East Oakland, which is again, sort of predominantly where people of color in our city live. And it's been a really challenging reception because I'll say frankly, I feel like in some cases we might've missed the mark or that we have even more work to do. Some folks have said, this is great, but I don't bike, right? I don't even have time to walk outside because I'm actually an essential worker. And that's really, again, an interesting intersection that we didn't quite calculate on. The other issue though, and it's, I will say sort of frankly, it's sort of heartbreaking to hear some of the deeper, almost paranoid responses about safe streets. And I'll share one of them with you cautiously, which is that some people approached us and called me on the phone and said, I don't trust you to not arrest me when I use the street? Are you telling me that it is safe for me to walk and play in the street, in the same street that I feel over-policed in on a daily basis? Is this a trap? Is this a trick? And it kind of breaks my heart to have that as a response, because again, as a person of color, I understand that every day, no matter how much privilege I may have. And so I only share that as a story to kind of explain that the narrative around slow streets is really nuanced. And that in some ways I find myself sort of convincing people, or trying to convince people, that they deserve safe streets and safe access to their own front door, to their own streets. And having that conversation is really, really tough, because originally when we connected with our East Oakland partners, with our advocates, they said, why are you doing this? We need testing, we need masks. And again, that goes back to my holistic view, right? That we can't just approach people with a transportation solution when they're looking for another type of response as well. And very fortunately, we are now, you know, this is a very iterative process. We're promoting soft closures on different intersections to promote additional safety. This weekend, we're actually partnering with our advocates to put out free COVID-19 testing information on all of the barricades, so that it's sort of doing double duty. So we really are trying to each week learn from what we're hearing and try and address people physically and figuratively where they are in place and in this dialogue. But to sort of answer your question, the reception has been kind of all over the map. But fortunately, our team is all ears. I mean, we have regular, like weekly, bi-weekly calls with people like, okay, how did it go this week? What can we improve on? And then that week, that weekend, we go out and fix something to make it a better program.
Great. That was a great answer, very thorough answer. Really appreciate that, because I think you probably answered a lot of the questions that I bet a lot of our audience today has about your street closure or restriction initiative. So Phil, the pandemic is obviously been a particular crisis for one of our most vulnerable populations, the unsheltered, including both those who are in, you know, tenuous or kind of temporary housing situations, as well as those who are already really, you know, living in public spaces even prior to the crisis. Can you talk a bit about how public space managers can work with our social services agencies and others to ensure that people experiencing homelessness are able to just meet their basic needs right now, such as food, hygiene needs, and access to shelter?
Sure. You know, in normal times, public spaces are hubs for the community that often draw unhoused people who are, you know, looking for a place to hang out, maybe make some money, get information, connect, get food. That's just been really exaggerated during the COVID-19 crisis, especially because a lot of the indoor spaces that unhoused people rely on are closed. You know, the other places are all shut down. So public spaces become more and more, you know, the default place for that activity. And so how to respond to that? You know, we're seeing some really interesting success stories, which actually predate COVID, but that have really responded well to the current crisis. So for example, Woodruff Park in Atlanta, which is a downtown small park that we worked with a couple of years ago with Central Atlanta Progress. You know, when we started working with Woodruff Park, of course, the initial idea was to create a great public space that's vibrant and fosters social connections for Atlantans. But it's really become this more resilient space that has contributed to well-being even now. So during, you know, it had a homelessness problem prior to COVID-19. And one of the ideas that we came up with was to actually, you know, we're big believers in park in public space management, and that they're, you know, successful public spaces often need a presence on site to manage the experience and be the host and the ambassador, like Carol said, really critical role. In this case, I think this is a maybe the first time that we've done this, and I don't know of another example, but one of the staff people at Woodruff Park that was hired was a social worker, like a licensed social worker. And so she is part of that small park staff. She is one of the ambassadors, and she does a variety of things, but she's also a qualified social worker who works with the houseless and homeless population in the park. So she gets to know them, she greets them, she knows their names, she's building trust over time. And she services them. So she'll ask them, what kind of help do you need? And she has, you know, her fingertips on all the city's resources in terms of agencies that can back up, you know, her offer. So during the last, I think, year and a half or so, she's placed at least 300 people in shelters and almost 150 people in permanent housing just through being on site in Woodruff Park and being that person who's trusted and who's like this ongoing presence. So, during COVID, she can play an even larger role in this task. And during the lockdown, of course, the homeless are almost the only people in that park, as is the case in many public spaces. There's a lot of other things that go along with doing this well. One is PPE, right, which we hear about over and over again. So how do you protect your service workers and your population who's in those public spaces by approaching them with the safety precautions in place, like face masks and other PPE? When it comes to food distribution, we've seen that public space managers can really work with public space experts, experts to provide food. A lot of these food shelters have actually shut down, and so they're looking for other ways to distribute food safely. So these public spaces can become a really important place to provide that role. Another interesting thing back to Woodruff Park is that they've actually brought in mobile washing stations. So they have a bathroom, they've kept it open through the lockdown, but they've added these mobile hand washing stations so that there is an additional level of hygiene that can help those folks who are spending their time there really protect themselves. You know, there are other examples like the city of Portland, Oregon has tried out these containers that are daytime storage units. So they actually, they're supervised and lockable storage containers where, people who have possessions but don't have a house can put them there, and they can trust that they're kept safely and they're not going to get stolen. And they actually come with outlets and Wi-Fi, because a lot of this need for an outlet is vastly curtailed for the houseless population, because they can't go into a restaurant, they can't go to McDonald's or Starbucks and charge a device. So that's another feature in that storage container. So I just think, and I hope we'll continue to explore it, I think there's an incredible range of ways that public spaces can serve the needs of people in a crisis, including, temporary shelter. So, we haven't seen very much of that in the news lately. I remember working years ago on a project in Armenia after an earthquake where the central square of Gyumri, Armenia became temporary housing. And then we were able to come back as USAID had built permanent housing and was relocating people, to work with the population to reimagine again, how do we restore this iconic place as the heart and soul of the center of your city? But meantime, it did a really good job providing temporary housing through the kinds of shelters that aid organizations are able to bring in.
Great. Thanks so much. I mean, obviously, these are just really, really complex issues that are just made more vivid during this moment. So we've talked about, you know, where your organizations have been, and certainly the range of things that you and other partner organizations are doing in this moment. But I want to pivot a little bit to look forward. So, you know, after nearly 2 months of lockdown, near lockdown in many states, the conversation is starting to pivot to, you know, how do we begin to reopen our economy safely? But it's going to be a really difficult road, and one that hopefully will lead us back not to normal, but to, you know, really a just far more just and a more equitable country. So what I want to do is talk a little bit about what that future looks like in the context of public spaces in the near term, but also in the months and really in the years to come. So Phil, I'm going to come back to you for a second. You know, many restaurants and other retail and service businesses have obviously been quite devastated by the pandemic, particularly many Black-owned businesses and those that are located in low-income communities. Yet, you know, even when those businesses are able to begin to reopen, when they're allowed to reopen for on-site patrons, demand's going to remain pretty low if people don't feel safe and they don't feel comfortable or that they can be protected in those spaces. So as the weather in this part of the world warms, how can we start to be thinking a lot more creatively about opening the public realm, you know, streets, parks, parking lots, for businesses, for restaurants? You started to see a little bit of this in some of the cities, Pensacola, Tampa, and Florida, but also, you know, businesses like barbershops, which might be at least while the weather's warm, a stopgap as we start to focus on reopening. And, you know, how in that context can leaders really ensure that some of the most vulnerable businesses in the most vulnerable communities are prioritized?
Well, so I'm going to answer your second question first, because then I'm going to follow that by a whole long list of ideas for how public spaces can be put to good use. But I just want to caution, you know, the priority has to be on these neighborhoods that need help the most. And the priority also has to be on working with those residents and find out where their needs are. So, you know, we can come up with a bunch of great ideas, and they could be the wrong ideas. And we don't want to be the technocrats who are here to solve your problem without asking them first, what problems do you need solved, you know, above all else. So then to your first question, I really do think this is a time where we can think expansively about the role of public spaces and how they can be put to a different range of purposes that we haven't necessarily seen traditionally, at least in North America. So, you know, for example, the reopening of neighborhoods through public markets. Public markets are incredibly agile and incredibly vital to bringing food to all types of communities, and they can operate almost anywhere. Cities, you know, we think should really be exploring how to expand and support their market systems and increase that food supply. And bring food closer to where people are holed up. You know, Barcelona, for example, has a big market program where no resident is further than a 10-minute walk from a public market. We'd love to get to that point at someday, but, you know, now we need to reach into those neighborhoods that are food deserts, and markets is one way to do that. We need to look, you know, beyond parks to, like you said, Jennifer, parking lots, streets, alleys, all kinds of distributed public spaces that can reach closer to people's homes so that they don't have to travel far. And then almost every conceivable use should be considered for opening up in the public realm, because as the warm weather visits us, there is more and more space that is safer to operate in out of doors than in. And so I think allowing businesses to open out of doors where they can at least do some of their operations is a really exciting prospect. Now, again, to Warren's point, it would be very easy for this to become over-policed. And so I would favor, you know, if cities can sort of create these bureaucracy-free zones and allow things to go outside that under normal regulations would never be permitted. And for the regulations to focus on health and safety, obviously, and physical distancing, and the kinds of guidelines that help these things roll out successfully, like we've done with public markets in three cities. You know, we're working with Arup to define very clear guidelines for spacing out vendors and shoppers so that they can go ahead and operate safely. But anyway, so I think outdoor restaurants, outdoor food, outdoor vending, different types of retailing, and then services. You know, you mentioned haircuts. I think, you know, we could be ready for that soon. Laundry pickup, drop off, pet grooming, manicures, pedicures, services like meal distribution and the temporary washrooms, like they've been doing in some public spaces, health clinics, some neighborhoods, you know, housing may be what they need and a parking lot might be the place to put it. Civic uses, you know, public free civic uses, hopefully. So I think we need to start thinking about this. How would we safely roll out an exercise class in the street, walking classes, recreation programs, you know, libraries that use more of their outdoor space than in, vegetable gardens. Can we set up vegetable plots in the street, in the parking spaces? I don't know, Jennifer, maybe we could do safe dance parties in the street. You know, maybe we'd have to mark it off so that everybody's 10 feet apart. But, you know, you can imagine one of those silent dance parties happening in the streets of Oakland, right, Warren? I mean, I think when we start to explore these things, it could actually become a really soulful experience for all of us who are looking for, you know, we're dancing on our balconies right now and we're clapping for the emergency response workers, but we need to expand that menu and tap our local talent, tap our local artists, tap the ideas of people in the community. You know, we want the micromobility to get, you know, around town and to our places of work. But I think the combination of these ideas can create these really unusual experiences that put our communities back together, both economically, but also just in terms of our, you know, our connections to other people and bringing healthcare,
sure,
and place management into neighborhoods that haven't seen them before.
So I think, you know, the watchwords are really creativity and flexibility. So Warren, I want to pivot you actually and talk a little bit about, you know, building on some of the comments that Phil said, and as we even think beyond kind of the reopening, you know, even in the context of street, you know, restrictions, you know, people have been calling for this certainly prior to COVID. So how permanent do you think we can make some of this reopening of public space? And do you see that happening in Oakland, or eventually are we just going to kind of, you know, go back?
I'm going to step aside from that question a little bit because I'm not allowed to say that any of this can be permanent because it's all a pilot. But I can tell you that for sure, the thing that we're taking from this that is absolutely permanent is the lessons learned, that this is in fact possible, even if we change it completely in the future, right? That it is in fact possible to close a bunch of streets overnight and that the sky won't fall down. To touch on Phil's point, I just wanna add to that because I know we're short on time as well, that we are sort of exploring the, like, maybe we expand parklets around our businesses. Let's do street closures on the weekends, like Sunday streets. The big issue here though, in thinking about our communities of color and our sort of disadvantaged businesses, is that it's one thing to just say, okay, you can request a parklet, but it's an altogether different effort to look at the regulatory scheme around how to get a parklet and say, can we make this easier? So just very technical for the folks, you know, listening at home, that we're thinking about adjusting the permit itself to make it just super simple, like idiot proof and also free, so that you can apply for these types of mechanisms. And then thinking, okay, in advance of that parklet that you're going to want to request, do you need a business permit to adjust that you can operate alcohol outside? Okay, can we adjust the cabaret license that goes along with that. And if you need a, there's a sound ordinance that we have. Okay, can we adjust that as well? So that all of this can be super streamlined and really simple for folks to just get back to business immediately. So it's not just opening up the public space, but it's also opening up regulatory schemes that made all of these things sort of challenging just from a paperwork process, and quite frankly, saving my staff some time going through all that paperwork as well. So I just wanna lift that up as well.
Yeah, and certainly these are the things that we should be thinking about, you know, in terms of permanency. Probably some of these things should have been done a long time ago, and maybe this is the moment to ease up on some of these regulations. So Carol, I'm gonna ask one sort of meta question here, and then I'm gonna combine it with one of the questions that came in from one of our viewers. So in an earlier conversation that we had, you really emphasized this point that parks and other public spaces just really need to be considered essential infrastructure. And so do you think that the pandemic is actually going to help us shift in that direction? Or do you think in light of, you know, all the fiscal challenges that cities are going to be under as, you know, in the months, in the years to come, that actually the opposite might happen and that we'll start to see less investment in not just, you know, creating new public spaces, but even in maintaining them? And then that means, you know, equitable access to the spaces will just become more limited and not less. And I'm going to sort of combine that with another question I'd like to respond to, because I thought it was an interesting one. And maybe this gets to part of this issue about, you know, maintaining spaces and creative ways to do that. Is do you see that, you know, there's a role for new creativity even around workforce and hiring in kind of, you know, WPA style projects around tree planting and maintaining that may then help mitigate some of the fiscal constraints depending on you know, who pays for it?
Those are good questions. I think that I certainly hope that if ever we needed proof that parks matter, we've had that over the last month and a half, 2 months. So I would hope that parks, in fact, will be considered essential infrastructure. I also believe it's incumbent upon those of us who run parks to demonstrate that parks can be more than simply play and recreation and health. Totally essential benefits for the community. But I've been thinking a lot about this decimation of Main Street America. I was a small business owner. My daughter owns a restaurant. And I keep thinking, how will local and small businesses come back? And what role can public space play in helping them get back and giving them cheaper options in terms of how to do business less frequently, less demands, perhaps as Warren says, with less bureaucracy. And so that's something I'm thinking a lot about, and how could we help imagine that, create that, and host that for small businesses. In terms of the role for new workforce, I think workforce is a place, frankly, that we are not thinking big enough in the country. And that then makes it very difficult because of financial flows to think big enough at city levels. Certainly, we have an opportunity to give people things to do and meaningful things to do on a volunteer basis. But, you know, where we've lost a lot of earned revenue and a lot of people are taking, you know, municipal budget cuts in our world, it is very difficult to think, well, where would we get the funds to employ more people? I mean, it's just tough to think about. But if we had federal consideration, you mentioned WPA, I mean, we can put those people to work all day long and in meaningful jobs that gain skills and move you on to the next level. I worry about the internships, the paid internships for, you know, kids in high school and college, and that missing out on that, I mean, which is very much needed income and very much needed skill building. And just learning the ways of work it's going to be missing this summer, and I think we'll all be the poorer for it.
Yeah, no, it seems like there's a lot of opportunities. I mean, we already know that we have a lot of issues around, you know, youth, that kind of that missing group, and their ability to be employed, even, you know, certainly prior to COVID. And so this could really be an opportunity to think a little bit more expansively about how to engage that youth to get their sort of foot in the door, while at the same time, you know, maybe, you know, having that opportunity to maintain parks in their own neighborhood. So I want to ask, I have an interesting question here that we haven't really touched on so much. So I'll throw it out to the group. I'll paraphrase it a little bit, but it really gets it's sort of issues around the digital divide. You know, one of the things we're hearing about is for people that don't have good internet access at home, they're driving to parking lots and sitting outside of the public library, which has, you know, in many cases, allowed their Wi-Fi in the public realm, and or sitting outside of, you know, restaurants or other things that have that Wi-Fi access. But what does it really mean when we think about this digital divide, how the public realm can start offering, certainly not just now, but beyond that, more access to help bridge some of those digital divide gaps? And, you know, as we think about 5G digital capacity, and even, you know, this even ties into a bigger conversation about, you know, just wiring in general and kind of smart cities concepts, energy efficiency and others. What is that? How what are the opportunities there?
Well, I mean, just to say, I think the opportunity is obvious. Why do parks and public libraries exist? They exist because most of us can't afford to have our own park or our own library. So we collectively, build parks and public libraries. So to the extent that we can't all afford great digital, then we put it in a public place so that we can share it in common. That's what Civic Commons really ought to be about. So I think that's one of many things that we could pool our resources, if you will, under the guise of, you know, under the banner of public, and think about doing together today.
Carol, I would
I think
add
if you,
to your point.
If you follow the example of the city of Portland.
Go ahead, Phil, and then Warren.
You know, the city of Portland, that container idea that was focused on safe storage of people's possessions, but with Wi-Fi and outlets, you know, that's an idea that is infinitely expandable. And maybe that's something that we need to start looking at in terms of there being these pods that can be delivered to locations in neighborhoods that don't have, you know, any good Wi-Fi, and, you know, they can't get to a downtown location where there is public Wi-Fi, but the Wi-Fi can come to these neighborhoods along with, you know, a set of other services that can be, you know, including, you know, meals, programming, portable libraries. You know, there's all kinds of ways that you can think about that idea.
Phil, Warren, you want to jump in?
Sure. Echoing both of their points, I'll just share one of the challenges we've noticed in Oakland is, and I bring up the children that you kind of pointed out, Carol, that, you know, as kids are now learning at their homes, the biggest gap has been access to not just internet at all, but high-speed internet. Because if your parents are working on laptops from home, you've got a brother and a sister who are also trying to learn digitally. I'm on Zoom calls all day, happily, with colleagues that are like, hold on, I got to find the good Wi-Fi in the corner because my kid's in one corner. And that is a big challenge. And I think it's raising this issue that maybe 10 years ago when cities started exploring the idea that like everyone should just have free Wi-Fi or high speed internet, I don't think people took that seriously. And now I want us to return to that issue, because as we are starting to look at like what should be permanent, when I think about the congestion and the air quality that has been such a big issue for most all cities, and especially in the Bay Area, one of the things people have noticed is that we can address congestion on our freeways with better Wi-Fi service at home. And that's not a linkage that we typically think about, but it's something that I've been really encouraging our regional planners to consider, is that we need to explore these types of solutions in this sort of digital divide space as well.
Great. Yeah, well, I can totally relate to, you know, having a husband, three kids, all working, schooling from home. I just kicked everybody out today just to make sure that my Wi-Fi capacity could handle this webcast. So it is really a truism. And hopefully this will, you know, spur us to think about bigger and better solutions to bridge some of these divides moving forward. So we are at time in another 30 seconds. So I'm gonna have this be a wrap. Look, I really just want to thank all of you, the panelists, for sharing your insights today, for taking the time. I think this has really been fantastic. And I know I learned a lot from the discussion. I certainly hope our viewers learned a lot from the discussion as well. I'm sure that they did. And that, you know, that we're all really inspired to integrate a lot of what we learned into our work now, into our work in the future. So again, thanks to the panelists. Thanks to all the viewers for tuning in. If you want to watch it again or want to tell friends, this has been recorded, so there will be an opportunity to view it or to pass it on moving forward, and we'll make sure everybody gets a chance to do that. So thanks, everyone, and please be well.